Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of the coronavirus pandemic on global politics and international life. My name is Michael Fullilove and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down with experts to discuss the implications of the novel coronavirus for the world. Episodes 1 to 3 of COVIDcast are already online. This is the fourth installment in the series. And in this episode, I'll be speaking with Ben Bland about the looming coronavirus crisis in Indonesia and Southeast Asia. Ben is the director of our Southeast Asia program and an expert on Indonesia's political system. Before joining the Lowy Institute, Ben was an award-winning foreign correspondent for the Financial Times, with postings in Hanoi, Hong Kong, and Jakarta. He has extensive experience over the past decade reporting from across China and Southeast Asia. Welcome, Ben.
It's good to be here, Michael.
Ben, Indonesia is the world's fourth most populous nation with over 260 million people. Until very recently, though, we hadn't heard much about Indonesia and coronavirus. But just in the past 24 or 48 hours, that has changed. I've seen disturbing footage of Indonesians collapsing in the streets with respiratory failure. I've read about medical professionals resorting to the use of raincoats to protect themselves in hospital wards. Indonesia is reporting one of the world's highest death rates for the disease, and yet it's still only tested a few thousand people. So I guess the first question is, how concerned should we be about what's happening in our largest neighbor?
I think we should be extremely concerned about the situation in Indonesia, Michael, for two main reasons. So firstly, Indonesia has a health system that was already incredibly overstretched and underfinanced. So compared to its peers in the region and globally, Indonesia has some of the lowest ratios of doctors, of hospital beds and critical care units on a per capita basis. And Indonesia brought in a few years ago this comprehensive health insurance system, but it didn't really increase the funding. So the finances were already really stretched and there were questions about the quality of care. So into that weak system, we've then seen a government response which has been slow. It's been piecemeal and it's been quite confused in the communication to the public. So in the early days of the global pandemic crisis, we saw Joko Widodo, Indonesia's president, who's often known as Jokowi. He was talking about the need for Indonesia to use this as an opportunity to attract more tourists, to win some of the business, the manufacturing business that was leaving China or being shut down in China because of the crisis there. So his focus seemed to be completely wrong. We had a health minister who was going around saying that all Indonesians needed to do was pray and they would be protected from COVID-19. In the last week or so, we've seen the government reverse course in a way, which is good, but it's been too little too late for now. So we need to see much more given the fundamental weaknesses of the system and the fact that Indonesia has so many people. Java, the most populous island in Indonesia, is one of the most densely populated in the world.
All right. But I mean, leaving aside the kind of idiosyncrasies of Indonesia's initial response, isn't there a big structural problem in Indonesia and much of the developed world? And that is that people can't afford to stop working. They generally can't work from home. It's not full of knowledge workers. It's predominantly people who live hand to mouth. How does that affect the kind of response that Jakarta couldn't put in place to the coronavirus?
I think that's a really important point for people to understand. I mean, even here in Australia, we've seen the Prime Minister talking about the need to balance kind of the health mitigation effects against the damage on the economy, which does affect people's lives as well. And in a developing country like Indonesia, that's even more so. I mean, many, many Indonesians, in fact, probably the majority, are not working in the formal sector. The typical Indonesian, you know, isn't working in an office on a salaried job. It's someone selling satays, working as an informal driver, a house help, domestic help. It's all these kind of informal labor sectors which dominate Indonesia, where there is no social security, there is no protection. And people often marvel at the unemployment rate being so low in Indonesia. The reason is because people are too poor to not be able to work. So this is a real problem. It's something that Jokowi's spoken about, needing to balance the fact that a complete lockdown, which some people have been calling for, would really cause a lot of terrible impacts on people's lives because the state doesn't have the financial capacity or the bureaucratic means to really distribute help to people who need it right now.
All right, thinking about that second crisis, the economic crisis, how was the Indonesian economy performing before coronavirus, and what sort of predictions are we getting about the kind of toll that the virus will take on the Indonesian economy?
Well, Indonesia's had a remarkably stable economic growth trajectory over the last few years. In fact, it's been the most stable economy in the world. In fact, I'm hovering at around GDP growth of 5% per year. There are some questions about the data and how it's measured, but things have basically been ticking along at a solid level of growth. Not impressive, but it's very uneven. So obviously in Jakarta, in Bali, we see a lot of people getting very rich. And in a few other big cities around the country, like Surabaya, Makassar, Medan, but elsewhere, and even within some of these big cities, there's large pockets of people who are struggling to get by, who don't even have access to clean water. And as we said earlier, don't have access to good jobs or proper education. So it's been a very uneven pattern. And I think the concern is not just that the overall economy will slow, which is likely to do, but it's those Indonesians who are on the margins, which is many, either on the margins because they're informally employed or because they don't have access to proper healthcare or social insurance, etc., that those are the people who are going to be hit hardest, even if overall the economy doesn't slow that much. There are going to be tens of millions of Indonesians who are going to suffer really badly in the coming months.
Let me zero in on the kind of leadership that we're seeing from the presidential palace. You're currently writing a Lowy Institute paper on President Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he's called, and that book will be called Man of Contradictions. It'll be published by the Institute and Penguin Random House. We've seen different styles of leadership around the world, from President Trump to Prime Minister Boris Johnson to the Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, indeed to the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. How is Jokowi's very particular leadership style suited to this kind of crisis? How is he going so far?
Well, in almost 6 years of leadership as president, this is the first really major crisis Jokowi has faced. There have been quite a lot of other natural and environmental disasters over the last few years in Indonesia, but on a much smaller and localized scale. So this is really the first big test. And as I was suggesting at the start, it's been a pretty sluggish approach so far from Jokowi. I think we have to understand the kind of guy that he is. You know, he was a small town furniture maker who built a successful but small furniture export business. Then he was a mayor, and that's how he came to be president. So he's a guy who likes to go out into the field to see things with his own eyes. He has kind of a very nuts and bolts approach to managing the country, very focused on the economy. And I think that's really caught him flat-footed in this case, because with such a big crisis, tactics, which is really his specialty, is not enough. You need a strategy. You need powers of organization, of delegation, of control, of narrative and communication, whereas he's a guy who likes to see and do. And that's really not enough. So he's been out and about trying to inspect some of the emergency hospital facilities they've been building, but that's not good enough. What he needs to do is coordinate his team properly, and that hasn't been happening. Although I must say, in the last week or so, he has started to get it together. I think he's listened to some of the people warning him about the health effects and how that could damage the economy if he doesn't do something to mitigate it. So he's sort of snapped belatedly into action, but there still isn't really a clear communication strategy from the government. There isn't a clear narrative, and he's always struggled as a communicator. As I said, he's a man of action, not a man of words. But I think we need to give him a bit of a break right now. It is a difficult time for him. His mother recently passed away from an illness unrelated to the coronavirus. So I think that's going to add to the pressure on him. But thankfully, as I said, he has sort of snapped into action in the last week or so. So we have to hope that he and his government is able to take more coordinated action and become much better at getting its message out to the Indonesian public, because still that doesn't seem to be getting through. And to be fair, that's a problem a lot of our leaders have had around the world, that people just aren't listening when they're telling us about how serious this problem is and what we need to do as individuals to help stop the spread of coronavirus.
All right, Ben, let's widen the aperture. Let's expand the focus from Indonesia to other parts of the region. You've lived in Indonesia, in Singapore, in Vietnam. Within Southeast Asia, I guess Singapore and Vietnam are probably nominated as the countries that have had some early successes in confronting this disease. What did the Singaporeans and the Vietnamese do right? And what can other countries learn from their experiences?
It's interesting. Everyone's looking all around the world for examples of countries or cities or regions that have done a better job at managing this crisis. And also, that, of course, those who've done a pretty bad job. And the thing that strikes me about Singapore and Vietnam is that they're both ostensibly very, very different places. Singapore is a highly developed small city state. Vietnam is a developing country. It's big, more than 90 million people. It's much poorer than Singapore. But one thing they both have in common is strong one-party state systems with relatively effective bureaucracies, as well as sort of very strong culture of authoritarian control in society, and a high acceptance for intervention from the police and the state in people's lives. So people often frame this as a question of, you know, are authoritarian systems or democracies better at responding to these crises? But actually, in this case, I think it's more about, do you have an effective bureaucratic interventionist state and a popular acceptance of some sort of authoritarian control of people's lives? Because there are many authoritarian states that are more populist, driven by, you know, a single leader like perhaps Duterte in the Philippines, that don't have a high functioning bureaucracy or a high functioning one party system like Singapore and Vietnam. They've done a good job in the first phase in tracking and tracing a lot of cases, in quarantining people, and people's acceptance for state control helps that. I think that's important to understand. The problem now, though, for those two is the kind of re-import of cases as people return home from elsewhere around the world. They're facing a second wave of infections just as they'd come to really get on top of the first wave. So they're definitely not out of the woods yet.
Malaysia, on the other hand, is a messy democracy, and recently it's been particularly messy because the virus struck just as the former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad's government was ousted from power. How big a problem has that been to have regime change just as this bug is affecting the country?
I think it was incredibly unfortunate. I mean, not only was it regime change, if you like, but this was sort of a palace coup or a parliamentary coup. It was constitutional, but this was a sort of backdoor collapse of Mahathir's government. So it was very rushed, and the new prime minister had to really appoint a whole suite of ministers very, very quickly, just at the time when the crisis seemed to be breaking in Malaysia. So there was one really unfortunate case in which there was a huge religious event that was allowed to go ahead, and that's been responsible for many of the cases that Malaysia has seen. It's had more cases than any other nation so far in Southeast Asia, which is quite worrying, and Malaysia has moved swiftly to bring in a lockdown effectively on the movement of people, which in its first few weeks seems to be having some effect. It's now been extended, but there's still been very, very confusing messaging from the government. I think the Malaysian health minister is rivaling the Indonesian health minister for the most unhelpful, if not ridiculous, advice. So at the weekend, he was telling Malaysians that they needed to drink warm water because it would protect them by flushing the virus out. So I think that's a symptom of the fact that they've cobbled together this government very quickly. They haven't had a very coordinated approach either, although again, a bit like Indonesia, they're slowly getting on top of it. So we hope that that improves. But it's obviously extremely unfortunate to change your government in such a way right at the moment when such a huge crisis is breaking.
Mm. Ben, we haven't heard much from ASEAN, even though the regional organization is meant to have a sort of coordinating role with crises like this. What's happening there?
Well, I think this is an example of a trend we've seen the world over, that, you know, this crisis has really driven home to many of us both the importance of global cooperation in tackling these sorts of crises, but it's also driven home the reality in our current world that most people, most countries, most leaders turn inwards at a time like this. So ASEAN has done extremely little to coordinate, and that's simply because the member states themselves are all turning inward, looking to their own solutions, putting up their borders, just like we've seen in the European Union, for example, which is a much more cohesive and successful regional body than ASEAN. But even there, it's really been a country-led response. But it is unfortunate because, as Martti Natalegawa, the former Indonesian foreign minister, pointed out, ASEAN has spent years and years, like other organizations, sort of laying out these frameworks for regional responses to pandemics and other sorts of humanitarian disaster. But at the time of crisis, people really respond in a very unilateral way. Now, I think one thing we have to say is that there's a hope that we could be entering a second phase here. We know there's, you know, been a G20 call for finance ministers and leaders. And so maybe this has been the initial phase of unilateral national responses. And we could hopefully move into a phase in the next few months of more coordinated responses, because it's certainly true that in the end, these crises are going to have to be tackled by countries working together. All these countries in ASEAN and Southeast Asia share borders. There's high levels of population mobility. Hundreds of thousands of Malaysians work in Singapore. Many people from Myanmar work in Malaysia. Myanmar people also working in Thailand, etc. So these countries in the longer term can't solve this problem on their own. They have to work together to build trust, to help each other deal with the problem at source, and find ways to manage the disease in the months and years ahead while reopening their borders to allow commerce and the flow of people to start again. Otherwise, we're going to see the economic crisis continue for a very long time indeed.
All right, Ben, two final questions. First of all, to go back to the theme you mentioned about authoritarianism versus democracy in Southeast Asia, there's been a growing concern in recent years about a rising authoritarian trend. Will these two factors, first of all, the early apparent success of countries with sort of strong party leadership like Singapore and Vietnam, but also the draconian government responses to the pandemic, will those two factors tilt the balance, do you think, towards authoritarianism in Southeast Asia?
Well, as I said, I don't think it's a simple case that authoritarian states are necessarily great at responding to these things. I think it's a bit like that question of, is authoritarianism or democracy better at economic development? And the answer is, it depends, right? There are plenty of authoritarian states who are terrible at managing the economy, and there are some who are good at it, just like we can see the same for democracies. So I don't think there's an automatic follow through. But one thing I do think we've seen in pretty much every country in the world, including developed and consolidated democracies, is a sense that, you know, more authoritarian or draconian measures are needed. And at the same time, a fear that once those measures have come in, whether it be using our mobile phones to track our whereabouts to see that we're not spreading the disease, or whether it's, you know, police knocking on people's door or finding people in the street for being out in groups of more than two, there's a fear that these things, these measures won't retreat so easily, that bureaucrats, police won't give up these powers, and that people may prove to like them. They may be afraid for some time, and they may want the government to be in much more control. So I think everywhere in the world, and particularly in Southeast Asia, where most of the countries are either authoritarian in nature, or even in Indonesia, where it's democratic, they have deep authoritarian roots, that these sorts of powers may stay for a long time, and they may even have popular support. So I think it could be a dark time, unfortunately, for sort of personal freedom in the future to come, given the way the trends were going in the region already. But at the same time, it is understandable, given the scale of the crisis, that there is this desire for more government control. Unfortunately, as I said, it's the side effect. So in Indonesia, for example, we've already seen, you know, a young student arrested for criticizing the government online. He was accused of spreading hate speech. And I think, you know, there's a fear that these sorts of things that were already happening will spread and become more embedded in the system, because this, I guess, is a moment for the state to show its power. And many people are actually supporting that.
All right, Ben, the last question is, well, one of the themes that I'm interested in is how this pandemic is going to affect the position of China and the United States in the world. So let me ask you about how that's being seen in Southeast Asia. Obviously, the US and Chinese responses to the pandemic have been quite different. How are people in Southeast Asia viewing the Chinese and US responses?
Well, it's interesting. China has definitely switched its propaganda line, if you like, and it's now trying to drive home this point that it's here to be an example and to help others. It's been sending doctors to Cambodia and other developing countries to show that it's helping out. I think those missions have been quite limited, to be honest, but it's certainly clear to everyone in the region, as it is in the rest of the world, that the US response has been terrible. And I think it shows the US in a really bad light. But right now, I think most countries in the region are just trying to knuckle down and get on top of this problem, because they're still in the early phases of the outbreak. So I don't think most in Southeast Asia are yet looking at this through a geopolitical lens. But those that do would certainly be pretty concerned by the US response. I think the challenge is going to be not just for the US, but for Australia and others too, to find a way to do more to help Indonesia and others in Southeast Asia who need the assistance. Because it's not just about the great power competition question. That's there, of course, and China is going to be stepping up its efforts. But it's really about helping these countries tackle a genuine humanitarian and economic crisis, because that's the right thing to do. But also because these are our neighboring countries. And if we don't do that, there's going to be direct blowback onto us. So to get the world economy back on track, to fight the disease, we're going to have to find a way to give more help to Indonesia, to the Philippines and others. And it's not just about geopolitics.
Ben, thanks for that fascinating conversation about the novel coronavirus, how it's affecting Australia's largest neighbour, Indonesia, but also the broader region of Southeast Asia, the geopolitics, the humanitarian element, and of course, the economic crisis that we're going into. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues, Maddie Neist and Aaron Bassett, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And of course, you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on the virus and its effect on international life via the Lowy Institute's excellent digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you very much.